This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, Black Lives Matter, and that's why Black Power matters, according to the Black Is Back Coalition. Black religious leaders try to cope with the latest round of church burnings in St. Louis. And if Cuba can provide a cure for hepatitis C for all its citizens, why can't the United States?
But first, thousands of protesters from around the country descended on New York City for 3 days of protest against police lawlessness. The Rise Up October demonstrations were called by the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, founded by Carl Dix and Dr. Cornel West. At Brooklyn's Borough Hall and Manhattan's Times Square, activists remembered the lives and the names of those snuffed out by the police.
Lois Boyd once said, the dead cannot bury the dead. The dead cannot speak out. And it is up to the living to be their voice. My name is Hortensia Peterson. A Kai girl was my nephew. I am standing here today in proxy of my sister Sylvia Palmer and Kenneth Palmer, a Kai's parents. A Kai was a father of a three-year-old and a six-year-old. Akai was a loving dad. He was very passionate in working in exotic cars. He was a mama's boy. He loved his mother. Akai did nothing wrong but decided to take the flight of stairs. 11 months ago, on November 12th, my nephew Akai celebrated his 28th birthday. 8 days later, he was murdered by a rookie police officer. Named Peter Yang, and his partner Sean Lando, who was doing vertical patrol in the Pink Houses projects in Brooklyn, New York. A guy and a friend was waiting for the elevator when it didn't come, they decided to take the stairs. It is a problem for anyone to walk in the stairs. What crime are you committing? You're not committing any crime. But because of Peter Yang and Sean Lando, My nephew is dead. My sister has a deep hole in her heart that cannot be replaced, cannot be healed. She is broken until she leaves this earth. My nephew Akai loved life. He was in the process of leaving New York City. He was in the process of moving out of this corrupted city where all these cops are murderers. The whole funny thing about it, they're protected by the law. They have to be held accountable for taking a life. If it was an accident, man up. The governor, the president, the Department of Justice, the whole entire justice system needs to be dismantled. We are losing our sons, our husbands, our mothers, our daughters. We are losing our family members because of police brutality. This must stop. Rise up, stand with the families of police brutality because we are here to be the voice for the dead. We are here. I thank you and God bless.
Could everybody say my son's name, Angelo Miller?
Okay, I am Alicia Kirkman from Cleveland, Ohio. I am so sick and tired of the police killing our kids because when they kill our kids, they kill a part of us. We would never, ever in our life be the same. My son was 17 years old. Him and his friends did something that they were not supposed to do. But how many of us never did anything being a teenager that we were not supposed to do? So the police officer shot my son's car up eight times. You heard my son on the 911 tape saying,
My hands are up, sir. I swear to God, I don't have nothing. I'm not doing nothing. How can they continue to kill our kids and try to pay us off? Why can't the police be put in jail for killing our kids? I am sick and tired. I am so happy that all of the mothers that we are getting together. This is the beginning of this. Because they need to stop it. And I am so sick and tired. Every time I see a young person, I don't care the age of the person. Every time I see that someone has got killed by the police, I would never, ever in my life heal. It brings back nightmares. So we're going to continue to fight this battle, and today is not the end. This is just the beginning of it.
My name is Christine Williams. This is my youngest brother, Shane Evans. I am my brother's keeper. I said I am my brother's keeper. I'm going to continue to fight for Shane. A part of me is gone. I will never get that part back. To see my mother go through what she goes through every day, it's not a good feeling. I tell them in San Francisco every day, when it rains, my blood is running in the streets. You're taking a part of me. America! I'm tired!
Radio was helpful in covering this story.
While Rise Up October activists were demonstrating in New York, families of victims of police violence were testifying before the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights in Washington. The commission is an investigatory arm of the Organization of American States. Officials from the U.S. State Department and the Department of Justice were also on hand, as Martinez Sutton recounted the day the cops killed his sister.
On March 21st, 2012, my sister Rekia Boyd was out enjoying herself on the west side of Chicago in Douglas Park. She called me and let me know that she wasn't coming home that night. I didn't know that she meant she was going to be gone forever. It was around 100 people in the park that night. Rekia and three other friends left the park and decided to walk to the store. one block west of where they originally were. En route, they came across a black Mercedes-Benz coming out the alley that they were about to cross. The vehicle stopped in the alley, and the occupant, who was later known as off-duty officer Dante Servin, exchanged words with the group, which was established as being non-threatening. As Dante Servin made a left, which was heading east out of the alley, which was a one-way street heading west, he stopped his vehicle about five feet from the alley. One of the males in the group, Antonio Cross, turned and yelled, "What do you want? I told you we don't have no drugs." As soon as he finished his sentence, Service extended his arm out of the window and started firing his handgun. He stepped out of the vehicle and continued firing. The end results being Antonio Cross was shot in his hand, while my sister Rekia Boy was shot in the back of her head. The reason why Rekia is dead because he didn't like the noise that was coming out of the park. Dante Servin stayed across the street, directly across the street from the park. It was deemed a justified shooting, but they had nothing to justify it with. There was no weapon found, no weapon on any person in the group. No weapon on any person in the group, nor was anyone in the group being confrontational. So where's the justification? I met Dante face to face a few months later, and he showed me how he killed my sister and asked me, what do I want to happen? I told him I wanted him to go down for what he did, and he expressed the best thing for me to do is to sue the city, take money, and take care of my family and leave well enough alone. When I let him know I thought otherwise, he stated, okay, if this is what you want, it's like he knew he would have gotten off. Trial was set for April 2015. Which lasted about 2 to 3.5 weeks. On April 20th, 2015, George Porter ruled not guilty due to the charges that were put against Servin. The prosecutors charged Servin with involuntary manslaughter. Judge Porter declared the charges shouldn't have been anything but murder. He stated the prosecutors had failed to provide the right charges. The pain that I feel in my heart will never be healed because of the psychological trauma that plays in my head on a constant basis. There was no help offered to help soothe the pain that me and my family feels. No mental health services offered, not even an apology for taking my sister off this earth. The constant harassment I received from police officers for speaking up about the loss hasn't died down yet. At times I feel like I am the next to die, and it can happen to me at any given moment. The pain in my mother's eyes, along with the constant flow of tears that fall down her face, is never ending. How can I dry up a river of tears with Kleenex? Explaining to my children, my nieces, my nephews that their aunt is never coming home is tough. Especially the youngest ones that always expect for her to walk through that door. In a search for answers, I've just been presented with more problems that seem to have no solutions. I was taught as a youth to never hit or disrespect a woman. My sister was hit in the back of the head and disrespected for being an innocent victim. What is this world coming to? If we continue to look past the presence of our woman, our future will cease to exist. I'm still trying to find justice, but then I'm finding out that what is justice? To me, it's just ice to numb the situation. I'm still trying to find answers, and I'm hoping that y'all can help me with them. Thank you.
Attorney Justin Hansford also testified before the Organization of American States Commission. Hansford is a professor at St. Louis University's School of Law. He said the U.S. criminal justice system is soaked in blood and needs to be dismantled.
The United States asks us to assume that these systematic extrajudicial killings result from a long-running mishap or the simple failure of attempts at colorblind criminal justice. But today I'm going to ask you, Commission, to shift your lens. In general, the discriminatory laws on policing and criminal justice are holdovers drafted by state lawmakers who maybe a few years earlier drafted Jim Crow poll tax laws as a way to ensure white domination through pretext. What if our criminal justice problems are not as unintentional as a few bad apples here and there, but as intentional as policy choices? What if the system is not inefficient or in need of reform, but working exactly as it was designed to work? consider racial profiling. Under the International Covenant to End Racial Discrimination, state, local, and federal government must avoid promoting de jure or de facto discrimination, even when no intent can be proven. Broken windows policing, reframed as community policing often by the 21st Century Policing Task Force, for example, often targets Black and Latino communities for more police contact, even if it's through a non-racial pretext. When Blacks are arrested and jailed at grossly disproportionate rates because of this targeting, they are seen as stereotypically criminals. The narrative of Black criminality created by racial profiling ends in the results that you see here, with more profiling and more excessive use of force. Currently, not a single state law of excessive force complies with international human rights standards. The UN Code of Conduct for Law Enforcement Officials and the UN Basic Principles on the Use of Force in Firearms by Law Enforcement Officials require police to minimize damage and respect and preserve human life and dignity. Instead, the U.S. constitutional standard laid out by the Supreme Court in Tennessee v. Garner contemplates the shooting and killing of fleeing suspects, a reasonableness standard in the use of force that emphasizes a police officer's own, often unreasonable and non-genuine expression of his feeling of personal fear and the common use of humiliation as a tactic. Often they will simply yell, "Stop resisting," even without cause, and use that as a basis for savage violence, even against human rights defenders. The culture of impunity created by these laws lies at the heart of all the heart-rending stories you heard earlier a few minutes ago. Both criminal proceedings and internal reviews are plagued by unreliable police testimony, unenthusiastic prosecutors, limited evidence due to the influence of police unions, and secrecy in violation of the principles of independence and impartiality under international law. The United States, in its Policing Task Force final report, acknowledges the past role of policing in racial subordination. That acknowledgement must be followed by reparation, and not a reform of racialized policing, but in a complete, total abolishment of it. At some point, we will have to muster the courage as a society to demand more than simply asking to retrain the monster, or set up a review board for the monster, or put a body camera on the monster. Eventually, global civil society will have to defang this monster and put it to sleep once and for all. Thank you.
That was Attorney Justin Hansford speaking at the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights in Washington.
The Black is Back Coalition for Social Justice, Peace, and Reparations holds its annual rally in March on the White House, November 7th, followed the next day by a conference at Howard University. The coalition is demanding Black community control of the police and will march under the banner Black Power Matters. But there has been no real discussion of the meaning of Black Power for many years. We spoke with Black is Back Chairman Omali Yeshetela.
I think that we are at a really important point in history, because if you remember, Glenn, even in the 1960s, after the Black Power slogan was thrust out into the world and that excited and electrified a lot of Africans and other people around the world, there still was a struggle happening within the movement of what Black Power means. But that struggle did not actually realize itself sufficiently, because the government murdered and destroyed people who were advocating Black Power, advocating self-determination for African people, including Malcolm, the members of the Black Panther Party, etc., before the struggle actually satisfied itself. And so we've had this dry spell for more than two generations after this happened, because in its place, we have seen that people who were opposed to Black Power, however it's defined, people who were opposed to self-determination, I'm talking about in our own communities, who saw themselves seeing their future tied to imperialism, tied to the very same social system and actual arrangement that oppresses us all, those people have been thrust into prominence as a consequence of the destruction of the Black Revolution, the Black Power movement, and those of us who stood for that. So that is the thing that happened to us then, and it's been a very difficult dry spell for more than two generations. And then, after all the killings and all the horrible things that's been happening to us that had just beaten the people down, and all the charlatans being able to mislead the people and keep us off track, we saw on August 9, 2014, after this man, Darren Wilson, dressed in a police uniform, killed Mike Brown in this explosion of resistance that was sustained long enough. In fact, it's actually going on even as we have this discussion, that it forced the world to be able to see what was the conditions that Africans are suffering from. And it thrust upon the agenda of black people ourselves the whole question of what blackness means, what our connection to Africa is, what is struggle. And you got now people who have not had any association with the black revolution or anti-imperialism struggle in our community, and who just a little more than a year ago would not even entertain the discussion. We can't shut them up, because the whole African community in this country has been excited and consciousness driven through the roof as a consequence of the resistance stemming from Ferguson. So it's a new era now, and we're all involved in trying to give some kind of leadership and direction to it. But we're in a contest today with the very same forces we were contending with after the destruction of our movement. And a lot of people would misdirect the struggle, would misinform the struggle, would distort the history of our whole movement to convince people that the only thing we really want is to be accepted by white people and to be loved by America.
So when one says black power matters, it's really a discussion about black self-determination.
It is a discussion about black self-determination. It's not even an attempt at this point to say what that looks like, but it does say that it's got to be about self-determination, that if we want people to stop killing us, that what we have to do is have the power ourselves to stop it, that we have to drive a movement in the direction of black people accepting responsibility for our own future. And so we say black power matters, and as it relates to the police, we say black community control of the police. And if we can ignite a movement, if we can drive a movement in the direction of demanding control of that arm of the state with which we have the closest, most ubiquitous kind of relationship, if we can put the idea of power on the brains of African people, something that happened in the 1960s, and when it happened in the 1960s, what it did was to place the struggle of black people in this country at one with the struggles of other people who were struggling for power, except they called it struggling against colonialism. Whether it's in Vietnam, whether it's in South Africa, any other place around the world, when that happened, it took the struggle of black people in this country out of this context of trying to reform America and make America better and somehow fitting into it, and it placed it in the context of the same struggle that people in Vietnam and Bolivia and all around the world were struggling for, and that is to have control of our own lives, to be, we were opposed to colonialism as it impacts on African people in this country.
In many demonstrations over the past year or so, we do see placards that say things like killer cops out of our community. But there is not a demand emanating from the Black Lives Matter movement or its Campaign Zero component for black community control of the police that would eradicate these killer cops from our community.
I think that's right, and I think a lot of work is being done. I don't think it's an accident that these demands are not being made. I had an opportunity to have a struggle with one of the leaders of the hashtag Black Lives Matter movement and raised this issue, and it's not an accident. In fact, they were very emphatic, or he was, and Julius Jones, very emphatic about what they were about is changing the hearts of Hillary Clinton. And he said, we know that Hillary Clinton is probably going to be the next president of the United States, and the objective is to change her heart. And we said, well, Hillary Clinton herself is telling you that it's not about changing her heart. It's about policies. It's about what kind of demand that you have to make. And so it's not an accident. They're very clear on what they're doing. Any more is it an accident that someone would call for a justice or else march as opposed to saying what else? The whole notion that somehow you can go to Washington, D.C. to get justice, of course, is ridiculous. And most African people understood that. And so there were probably 1 million African people who went to Washington, D.C., knowing that there was no justice there, but hoping that there would be an or else there. They went there for or else, and of course that was not delivered to them from the platform and from the people who called that mobilization. I think they're one and the same. This whole thing of obscuring what the real questions and issues are, they function as obscurantists. So that they don't identify, they don't create a target, they don't identify imperialism, they don't identify the Obama regime, they don't identify anything wrong with America. And it's like knowing that people want to run and thrusting them on treadmills so that they can run like hell and exhaust themselves but never get anywhere. So that's the kind of thing that I think we're faced with today, and that's why I think the coalition plays such an important role. And that's why I think that all the people, so many people were disgusted. Some people didn't go. And you think about this, there are possibly 1 million people there and a lot of people who didn't go because they didn't expect anything from that process. And then a lot of people who went there were disgusted because there was, nothing came from it. So this is a call by the coalition to say that the people who went to Washington, D.C. looking for the or else, that you can find the or else with the mobilization that the Black is Black Coalition will be doing in Washington, D.C. when we have our rally at Malcolm X Park at noon, when we have our march from that rally site to the White House, and then on the 8th, the second day, when we have our conference to discuss some of these critical issues with no ambiguity about the else, but actually trying to lay out and define what's happening in the real world with a materialist perspective as opposed to some obscurantist or religions or superstitious take on what's happening in the world. The coalition, I think, is the appropriate response, and I think that increasingly more and more people will see that.
We saw that the Occupy movement dissolved into the presidential election of 2012. Is there the danger that the incipient movement that arose last year will dissolve in the presidential campaign of 2016?
The reason I don't think that will happen is because the Occupy movement, as important as it may have been, was different. Because here you have an African population that itself could have been absorbed by the Occupy movement, but now is coming to some kind of consciousness about its own condition, its own relationship to America. And this has been the driving force for progress in this country since Africans were kidnapped and brought here. And I like to remind people who were like these Obama supporters and who said that if we don't vote for Obama, then fascism is going to descend upon us, etc. Therefore, we have to support Obama, support the lesser imperialist evil. And I like to remind people that what it was that kept this proto-fascism from occurring in the United States was not a struggle against fascism, but it was a struggle that was led by people like Fannie Lou Hamer and Ella Baker and down in the South who really are responsible for whatever has been defined as democracy in this country subsequent to that time. And the Black liberation movement in this country getting its footing and Black people coming to consciousness is different from stopping a worker's struggle as it's recognized, generally speaking, in the factory or something like that is a people struggle. And I think the role of the coalition, that's the thing that makes us so important, is to continue to take that understanding out there. And I don't think this is going to go away. I think we will help it not go away. I think we have a responsibility to help it not go away. I think we are conscious that it cannot go away if we are ever going to win our freedom. This is a moment that I don't believe that we can lose. And we're not going to have the hundreds of thousands of people or anything like that that Farrakhan was able to bring to Washington, D.C. in October. But we are getting more and more critical forces, people who want to actually change and not just come out and be spectators, but who want to participate in transforming the world. So all those people who are interested in the what else is to be found in the coalition, and we are continuously calling on those people who are disgusted about a lost moment or what could have been a lost moment in October to come and recapture and complete this whole revolutionary process that was initiated most recently in the 1960s. I believe this is our time, and I believe that the coalition will make all the difference in the world.
What are the things that's missing in the current era, in the current incipient movement, in addition to coherent demands, is a position, a worldview regarding Black folks here and people's struggles in the rest of the world?
And I think that's really important, and there are several things about that, which is, One reason I appreciate the coalition so much is that virtually every conference that we have, we examine the world situation so that African people can contextualize ourselves in this overall world situation. And the world situation is one where our enemies are in a state of crisis because of resistance that's happening everywhere. That's one aspect of it. And that's a very important aspect of it, too, because Africans have an ability to sense a kind of isolation here and around the world, and that we don't seem to have friends and allies. It's not something that's easily or normally or naturally seen. But the other thing about that is, in September, I had the opportunity to be in Moscow at an international conference called A Dialogue of Nations and the Struggle for Self-Determination. And that was attended by different groups and peoples from throughout the world, from Ukraine, where people are actually involved in armed struggle against a U.S. imposed dictatorship that has been placed on them there, from Puerto Rico, from Hawaii, from the Western Sahara, from Ireland, from Italy, from Catalonia in Spain. And this important discussion happened, but we were in the middle of this discussion. And we were saying, this is what's happening with African people in the United States and in the world. And while we appreciate all of the sympathy that people have shown us about what's happening with Ferguson and subsequent to Ferguson, we need more than just well-wishing. We need for you to support our struggle for self-determination. We need you to support the demand for reparations. We need you to support the work that we're doing now to bring the United States before the United Nations for genocide, for defying the Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of Genocide. We need for you to recognize the right of African people in the United States to actually engage in armed self-defense from colonialism and colonial terror that's being waged against us. We need for you to support our demand for the release of all African people from prison in this country, particularly the release of African political prisoners. This is what we want you to do. And I think that we have all these people now. We just had a discussion with comrades from Russia, the anti-globalization movement of Russia. And as a consequence of this connection we have them, they're quoting Malcolm X. They're talking about Martin Luther King. They're talking about the right for African people to have reparations in this country. The Irish are saying that they support our struggle for reparations. So increasingly what is happening is that the struggle for black people in this country has been put on the agenda internationally. And people can see that. And people are trying to find a way now, as a consequence of our participation, to unite with that. This is a whole new era where the struggle of our people is something that's taken away from some kind of domestic agenda that's controlled by Washington, D.C., and it's placed on the agenda with the peoples of the world who are struggling for freedom, who are struggling for self-determination, just as we are struggling for self-determination, and it ends the isolation of our struggle. So the whole world now has an ability to see us not just as victims in Ferguson, but as people who are actively engaged in trying to change the relationship that we have with U.S. imperialism and actively engaged in trying to develop relationships with other oppressed peoples around the world.
So when the Black is Back Coalition talks about Black Power Matters, we're not talking about a parochially based movement, but one that embraces and wants to be embraced by the world.
Indeed. And that, I think, is just the new dynamic. And so despite, you know, the loss, and we had horrible losses to our movement in the 60s, but not just us, you know that. I mean, in 1967, October, this month, in 1967, after wounding Che Guevara, he was murdered by a U.S. CIA operative. I mean, Nkrumah was overthrown, Lumumba was killed by the United States, and in this country, scores of black activists were murdered by police organizations and the FBI, and so many of us thrown into prison. We don't even know the numbers who went to prison. So we suffered a real serious setback. But I believe that we are approaching a whole new era. And I've never seen this situation since the 1960s where so many of the African people in this country, not just activists, because there aren't really that many activists, not black nationalists as such, but just ordinary people who now are really interested in what can be done to free black people and who are prepared to entertain the discussion about the history of our oppression and what it's going to take to free us.
And much of that discussion will occur at Howard University the day after the march on November 7th.
And we've got some splendid forces who are going to be participating in that discussion. Some of them are known to your listeners, and certainly Margaret Kimberly, who is one of your editors, and the sister Marshall Coleman Adebayo will be one of the persons. And then we'll have Cam Howard out of Chicago, who is a reparations specialist, who will be speaking to us. Just an incredible array of people who will be presenting, and we're going to be examining some of the fundamental questions. Out of Ferguson, Missouri, Sister Hadoshia Bentham will be talking to us about the campaign for the Africans Charged Genocide and getting people to sign up to that campaign. So there's going to be some great discussion and examination of our situation, but beyond that, moving to actual practice, the kind of stuff that we have to do, the change stuff, so that we are asking people to come. And we are trying to encourage people to move beyond simply being information consumers and to participate in doing something. They don't even have to join our organizations, but they can go online and they can go to AfricansChargedGenocide.org and sign that petition, and they can share that. They don't have to join anything, but they can take out petitions and sign petitions demanding black community control of the police. We want to create thousands and thousands of people who demonstrate some kind of unity through practice, through signing a petition. That's a small thing that they can do with where it is that we're trying to go. And the weight of that solidarity can be translated into political power in the struggle that we're engaged in.
That was Omali Yesha Taylor of the Black is Back Coalition speaking from St. Petersburg, Florida.
Black congregations around the country are on alert in the wake of arson attacks on 7 black churches in St. Louis, Missouri. Reverend Anthony Evans is president of the National Black Church Initiative in Washington. He says the U.S. Justice Department appears impotent in the face of the church burnings in St. Louis and systematic attacks against blacks by racist police.
This administration has been slow to recognize the parallel of radical white supremacist elements in our society who is attacking and killing every segment of our population. They're attacking the church. It was a cold-blooded murder that occurred in Charleston. I was down there to personally supervise the security of over 500 to 600 black churches in that area, and also the continuous killing of African Americans by white, roguish, racist, murderous cops that in some cases we have caught on video. And this administration does not see a pattern of launching a systematic investigation against this mentality. And so the church cannot stand by while they continue to attack the church and say absolutely nothing.
The National Black Church Initiative is, of course, a coalition, so you're in contact with literally thousands of other congregations. Is this the judgment of many of the pastors that you talk to in terms of the lackluster response of the feds?
Absolutely. It's no question about it. I mean, right after Charleston, they did a couple of seminars around the country, and then we wrote a very extensive letter, which was a part of this press release, to the feds, and had over 500 ministers sign that to do specific things to make sure that there is a guard around the church, not only the African-American church, but any church, that any extremists will attack because of our religiosity. And there has been absolutely no movement. I had one meeting with the feds in D.C., and they promised to do several things. They have failed every single thing. I haven't even met with their faith-based person yet, which I've repeatedly asked to do so. So it's just crazy the way they have ran politics. But if this was a Jewish synagogue, a Muslim mosque, a white church, they would have acted completely different. They would have stumbled upon themselves. We give them a clear roadmap to follow, and they fail. And they fail because we are black. We catch hell not because we're Democrats or Republicans, remember. That's what Malcolm said. We catch hell because we're black. And now that we have a black attorney general, Ms. Lynch, and a black president, President Obama, they have failed consistently to protect the black community from these white, racist, murderous thugs that is on our law enforcement throughout the country.
And even their faith-based official has been unresponsive, you say?
I mean, not only have been unresponsive, she has not even been in sight. We don't know what her name is. We don't know what she does. And the faith-based person at the Justice Department, I wrote him. He never wrote me back. After, again, over 500 clergy signed a letter. And they believe they can dismiss us. But I'm determined to not allow this to happen and to keep the pressure on the administration and let him do his job for one reason, not because we're black. It's because we're an American. And he has the responsibility to protect all Americans, even black Americans.
You're reviewing a whole range of security precautions. You say that you and other ministers have tried to minimize guns in our communities, but following the Charleston tragedy and now this outbreak in St. Louis, the issue of guns is being revisited.
Well, you know, this is a very hot case for us. Our Christian stance continue to be that we will use no weapon against anybody, that we will continue to be nonviolent. But I cannot assure this administration and others that there are some churches in our coalition who may take matters in their own hands and completely arm themselves. Now, we do have armed guards at some of our churches. There's no question about that. This may even increase that mentality to the fact that when you come into an African-American church, you may have to be searched before you're let in. And certainly, we do not want that environment to prevail in our churches.
Now, the administration has not responded sufficiently. What's the next step?
Well, the next step is to keep the pressure on. And the administration, of course, has summoned the liberal African-American ministers, the bishops, to the White House and given them whatever they give it. But a bishop only is effective as much as he passed down those instructions to the local church. And those local churches do not have any means of protecting themselves. As it was very clearly demonstrated in Charleston, Mr. Roof walked in to that church, sat in that church over an hour, and systematically assassinated 9 people. And there is a rural white element in the Midwest, looks like it, in Ohio and across the country, who believe that they have to shut up the black church. And the way they're doing this is burning our churches. Remember, this is nothing new to us. They burned our churches over 400 years ago. So that today, they continue to burn our churches. But we have a modern society. We have a modern law enforcement community who seem impotent in finding out who exactly is doing this. So I'm lost for words and baffled and don't know what to do, but only to advocate nonviolence in my peril. That word will come back and haunt me as we allow these white role elements to come into our community, completely slaughtered us, and then the Justice Department will step in, late and without any power.
Yes, they seem to be able to intrude on all of our telephone calls and emails, but never hear these, as you describe them, white, rogue, racist elements in conversations preparatory to attacks on blacks.
Yeah, one of the things that we asked for in that letter over several months ago, I asked that the FBI give each of our faith-based communities in the South, in the Midwest, the West, the North, and the Northeast, a briefing on every single racist white group that they are monitoring. And today, I have not heard from the FBI. I have not heard from Homeland Security. I've sat down with the Justice Department, and I've requested this both in writing and in a meeting, and they seem not to be moving. Now, I'm not sure what it takes or how many black dead bodies it takes for them to react to us. And then one has to conclude that this president, he simply doesn't care.
Reverend Anthony Evans of the National Black Church Initiative. In St. Louis, Faizan Syed, director of the local chapter of the Council on American-Islamic Relations, expressed solidarity with the black Christian community.
In 2013, when I first graduated from college, I actually went to a city called Joplin, Missouri, that got hit by an F5 tornado. So myself and all the Muslims in the general area, we went to help the people there rebuild their lives. One year after that, somebody actually burned down the Islamic Center of Joplin, Missouri totally. And it was the first time in our recent memory that an entire Islamic Center had been burned totally to the ground. So when we see, you know, seven churches, one after the other, in such a short period of time, being targeted by arsonists, that makes us have understanding that, you know, we have gone through something similar, and we want to stand with the African-American community as they go through this type of tragedy and this type of crisis as well. That, you know, I personally know what it feels like to feel like you're, as if you're completely helpless, to feel as if you're alone, and, you know, to have that type of situation. Well, the main thing in Joplin, after that fire happened, the day after, it was the month of Ramadan, where Muslims fast from sunrise to sunset, and the local church in Joplin, Missouri, invited the Muslims to come and have dinner with them, to come and break their fast, and they made us dinner. And because of that, it really brought calm and a sense of peace into our hearts. And that's something that we want to do here in St. Louis as well, that we, in about a few weeks or so, we're going to try to host a dinner and try to invite the leaders of the African-American churches and their congregation, just the general public, to an Islamic center here for dinner as well. Because again, when, you know, this tragedy happened to us, a Christian community was there to help us and support us. We also have gone through this type of tragedy as well.
And what has been the response from the Black religious community in St. Louis to this offer of moral support?
Well, the Black community, of course, there's been multiple responses. One of the most beautiful responses was done by the pastor of the most recent church that was burned down. But when he was asked, you know, what do you think of what happened to your church that was burned? And he said that, you know, my job is to love them, and I have forgiven them, and it's now time for us to basically rebuild. And I think that has been one of the amazing leadership statements from a lot of the pastors and ministers from these churches. Another response is that from the Black community, that they do feel like they're under siege. They feel like they're being targeted by arson attacks. So many churches in a short period of time, it puts the community on edge and also has the ability to create fear as well. So I think much of their response is to quell those fears. Much of their response is to organize the community so that way they can all come out on top of this tragedy.
And have mosques and other symbols of Islam been threatened in St. Louis?
Periodically, there have been attacks against Islamic centers within the city of St. Louis. So, for example, they've had graffiti attacks. They've had property that's actually been vandalized or actually destroyed, such as windows and doors and other things. But nothing that can even be closely compared to what's going on within the African-American community right now.
And, of course, Black America includes a large proportion of folks who are themselves Muslims.
That's right. One out of every three American Muslims are actually Black American Muslims or African Americans. So there's a large population. It's actually the largest population of Muslims in the United States are Black Americans.
And have you enlisted support from these Black Muslim organizations that may not be directly affiliated with one might call mainstream Muslim mosques?
That's right. The Nation of Islam, especially here in St. Louis, they've been out on beat. They've been out to very much so support African-American community as they go through this type of tragedy. And then also African-American Sunni Islamic Center as well are also coming together with us in order to do this dinner, in order to do more outreach initiatives within the African-American community. As American Muslims, we realize and recognize that our liberation is completely linked with the African-American struggle for justice, equality, and fairness within this country. That until everybody is free, until everybody is free from terror, free from having the places of worship vandalized or assaulted or victims of arson attacks, then nobody can be free of it. And we hope to continue to stand in solidarity with the African-American community for them to overcome this type of tragedy, to overcome these types of intimidation tactics. In Joplin, Missouri, after that mosque was burned down, the man who burned it down made a statement that Muslims are not welcome in Joplin. Well, the result of his action was that people from across the world supported that community, and now the Islamic Center of Joplin is larger and the community is more vibrant than ever because of his actions. I hope and I believe and I pray that these terrible actions today will allow for people across the country and the world to come together in support of Black churches in St. Louis to allow their community to rise up and become stronger and more vibrant than they were before.
Faizan Syed of the Council on American-Islamic Relations.
Mumia Abu-Jamal, the nation's best-known political prisoner, is still being denied treatment for hepatitis C, the underlying cause of his near-death health crisis. Earlier this year, Mumia isn't alone. Tens of thousands of inmates suffering from the infection are left untreated in Pennsylvania and other prison systems around the country. At a press conference last week, Dr. Melissa Barber of IFCO, the Interreligious Foundation for Community Organization, charged the U.S. with violating the human rights of prisoners. Dr. Barber runs a program that sends U.S. students to Cuba for free medical school.
When we hear about situations like this and we want, you know, Mumia to be freed, and we talk about the political prisoners that need our care, medical care, and that are medically neglected, as well as the population at large, I know that the students that I'm sending over to Cuba are actually doing big things and becoming revolutionary doctors to come back and infiltrate the system and do great things. So that makes me very proud. And I kind of wondered, you know, what am I going to say? You know, how am I going to start my talk? And I just want to say that, like, just thinking on what to say, it brought me back to a moment, last year, where I had a young student from California, and he had run into the law, and he, you know, was a juvenile, what they call juvenile delinquents. He was able to turn his life around. And as part of turning his life around, he was like, I want to be a doctor. I know it's my purpose to be a doctor. Some of us, we look at our past experiences and we try to run from those things and kind of hide them and put them in the back and say, you know, that was the secretive part that I don't want anybody to know about. And I looked him dead in his eyes and I said, do you know the reason why you went through what you went through is not just for you, it's for everybody coming behind you, and it's for the people who need you. I said, so when you get that diploma and you become a medical physician and you know what that prison system is like as a juvenile sitting in that prison system, you can come back and begin to be a doctor in that system, and with the level of care and nurturing that you've been trained and ingrained to have to treat patients differently than the model that you've seen here in the U.S., you can come back and you can treat the prisoners in that system. And you can tell them where you come from and be proud that, yeah, you were in that and your life changed. And as a result of that experience, the compassion that you have now, you can actually go back and treat the people who you once were. And so that makes me proud to know that I'm a part of a system where not only was I trained differently to not see a patient as a dollar bill, but to see a patient as humane and a person. One of the reasons why I feel that I'm here and to talk about the system and how Cuba handles the system is, first, we have to talk about the model of healthcare just being a preventive type model. So you have a system where screenings are done. Everybody has access to free healthcare. So you're never running into a situation where somebody doesn't know what they have and that there's a condition that's allowed to escalate to the level at which Mumia had to suffer through because there was nobody checking and doing regular checkups to make sure that that wasn't the case. Right? And we're not in a system where mothers and children are not given access to health care, so our babies are growing up healthy. And we don't have all of these access conditions and diseases that are going on that go unchecked. Part of just talking about the Cuban model and the level of prevention that takes place and the level of the model being a family practice or community-based medicine and social-based medicine is that we have a doctor for, you know, within a 10-block radius for all of the patients that belong in that block. So you have one doctor for about 125 patients, if that, and a nurse to treat that same patient, and a doctor and a nurse living in the community and sometimes in the apartment complex as the families that they're treating. So you have access at all times to a primary care, you know, a first class, first level based. If, you know, there's something wrong, I can go and knock on my doctor's door and say, this is what's going on, and he can come and assist me. And after that level of care, if it gets out of hand, I can have a polyclinic that can do all of the laboratory work and all of the necessary stuff at that second tier to say, here's a specialist that you need, and you can go access that specialist when you need to access them on an everyday basis. right? And then if it escalates, you can go to a hospital, and this patient, you know, is referred to that polyclinic. We need you to go to the hospital because now this condition is a little, you know, is untreated, and you need a little bit more care than we can give you at this level. So we refer you to the hospital, and you go to the hospital, and you're taken care of there. And while you're in, you don't have to worry about not, you know, working, and you don't have to worry about insurance, and you don't have to worry about whether you'll have access to that medication because you can't afford it, because everybody is getting access to medication, and it's free of charge. And if it's not free of charge, guess what? I can go and get a medicine like an aspirin or anything else that I need for about the equivalent of a quarter. So I don't even have to pay for medicines and worry about paying for medicines and being exhausted to the point that I can't have access to medicine because I can't afford it. That's just not something that you see in Cuba. As I was studying in Cuba and as I was practicing medicine in Cuba, when there was a prisoner who needed help, they would come directly and be brought directly to the hospital. And no, they didn't have cracked jaws when they came, and no, they weren't scuffed up and beat up, you know, while they were taken to the hospital, but they were treated humanly, human beings getting treated humanely by physicians that can see them when they needed health care. So this is an alternative to what we see here. And we know that it can be done because it's being done on a daily basis, right? From a country with little resources. In 2009, when they started the Peg-Hebron, which is the hepatitis C vaccine that they have, that was open and free to everyone in the population since 2010. Since 2010. Everybody has access to this medication, and they have a demand for more production of that hepatitis C vaccine so that everybody who has chronic hepatitis can have access to it. So we're looking at an alternative system that's showing us with the little resources that they have that it's possible. It's possible to treat every single person that has hepatitis C on a private level. Money shouldn't be the issue. Because everybody is having access to that hepatitis C vaccine. It started in Havana in three hospitals where they were giving it in conjunction. You know, that the interferon that they have, which was a component of the interferon 2B2A with the gamma, a direct acting protease inhibitor. So they were in conjunction given that medication and finding out that it was 27% more efficient than the conventional treatments that they were giving patients. So it became one of the medicines that was registered in the 888 medicines that were a part of the profile to be added to Cuba's registry of medicines that everybody would have access to. So if we can do it in a country like Cuba, why are we not doing it here? As he said, you want to put a dollar on whose life is expendable and who's worth it. But human life is always worth it.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.